He walked incredulously down the stairs, out to the street, and looked up at the windows of her apartment. The windows were dark. He stood looking up at the windows, as at a tremendous betrayal. Then came a sick feeling of loneliness, as if he were homeless in a great city. For the moment, he forgot his own address or its existence. Then he thought of the meeting, the great mass meeting where her uncle was publicly to make a martyr of himself tonight. That's where she went, he thought, the damn little fool. He said aloud, "To hell with her!" And he was walking rapidly in the direction of the meeting hall. There was one naked bulb of light over the square frame of the hall's entrance, a small blue-white lump glowing ominously, too cold and too bright. It leaped out of the dark street, lighting one thin trickle of rain from some ledge above, a glistening needle of glass, so thin and smooth that Keating thought crazily of stories where men had been killed by being pierced with an icicle. A few curious loafers stood indifferently in the rain around the entrance, and a few policemen. The door was open. The dim lobby was crowded with people who could not get into the packed hall. They were listening to a loudspeaker installed there for the occasion. At the door, three vague shadows were handing out pamphlets to passers-by. One of the shadows was a consumptive, unshaved young man with a long, bare neck. The other was a trim youth with a fur collar on an expensive coat. The third was Catherine Halsey. She stood in the rain, slumped, her stomach jutting forward in weariness, her nose shiny, her eyes bright with excitement. Keating stopped, staring at her. Her hand shot toward him mechanically with a pamphlet. Then she raised her eyes and saw him. She smiled without astonishment and said happily, "Why, Peter, how sweet of you to come here." "Katie," he choked a little. "Katie, what the hell? But I had to, Peter." Her voice had no trace of apology. "You don't understand, but I..." "Get out of the rain. Get inside." "But I can't. I have to..." "Get out of the rain at least, you fool." He pushed her roughly through the door into a corner of the lobby. "Peter, darling, you're not angry, are you? You see, it was like this. I didn't think Uncle would let me come here tonight. But at the last minute he said I could if I wanted to, and that I could help with the pamphlets. I knew you'd understand, and I left you a note on the living room table explaining, and..."
"You left me a note?
Inside?"
"Yes."
"Oh. Oh, dear me, I never thought of that. You couldn't get in, of course. How silly of me. But I was in such a rush." "No, you're not going to be angry. You can't. Don't you see what this means to him? Don't you know what he's sacrificing by coming here? And I knew he would. I told them so, those people who said not a chance, it'll be the end of him. And it might be, but he doesn't care. That's what he's like. I'm frightened, and I'm terribly happy, because what he's done, it makes me believe in all human beings. But I'm frightened, because, you see, Wynand..."
"Well, keep still. I know it all. I'm sick of it. I don't want to hear about your uncle or Wynand or the damn strike. Let's get out of here."
"Oh, no, Peter, we can't. I want to hear him, and..."
"Shut up over there," someone hissed at them from the crowd.
"We're missing it all," she whispered. "That's Austin Heller speaking. Don't you want to hear Austin Heller?"
Keating looked up at the loudspeaker with a certain respect, which he felt for all famous names. He had not read much of Austin Heller, but he knew that Heller was the star columnist of the Chronicle, a brilliant, independent newspaper, arch-enemy of the Wynand publications, that Heller came from an old, distinguished family, and had graduated from Oxford, that he had started as a literary critic, and ended by becoming a quiet fiend, devoted to the destruction of all forms of compulsion, private or public, in heaven or on earth, that he had been cursed by preachers, bankers, club women, and labor organizers, that he had better manners than the social elite whom he usually mocked, and a tougher constitution than the laborers whom he usually defended, that he could discuss the latest play on Broadway, medieval poetry, or international finance, that he never donated to charity, but spent more of his own money than he could afford on defending political prisoners anywhere. The voice coming from the loudspeaker was dry, precise, with the faint trace of a British accent. "And we must consider," Austin Heller was saying unemotionally, "that since, unfortunately, we are forced to live together, the most important thing for us to remember is that the only way in which we can have any law at all is to have as little of it as possible. I see no ethical standard by which to measure the whole unethical conception of the state." except in the amount of time, of thought, of money, of effort, and of obedience, which a society extorts from its every member. Its value and its civilization are in inverse ratio to that extortion. There is no conceivable law by which a man can be forced to work on any terms except those he chooses to set. There is no conceivable law to prevent him from setting them, just as there is none to force his employer to accept them. The freedom to agree or disagree is the foundation of our kind of society, and the freedom to strike is a part of it. I am mentioning this as a reminder to a certain Petronius from Hell's Kitchen, an exquisite bastard who has been rather noisy lately about telling us that the strike represents a destruction of law and order.
The loudspeaker coughed out a high, shrill sound of approval and a clatter of applause. There were gasps among the people in the lobby. Catherine grasped Keating's arm.
"Oh, Peter,"
she whispered. "He means Wynand. Wynand was born in Hell's Kitchen. He can afford to say that, but Wynand will take it out on Uncle Ellsworth."
Keating could not listen to the rest of Heller's speech, because his head was swimming in so violent an ache that the sound hurt his eyes, and he had to keep his eyelids shut tightly. He leaned against the wall. He opened his eyes with a jerk when he became aware of the peculiar silence around him. He had not noticed the end of Heller's speech. He saw the people in the lobby standing in tense, solemn expectation, and the blank rasping of the loudspeaker pulled every glance into its dark funnel. Then a voice came through the silence, loudly and slowly. "Ladies and gentlemen, I have the great honor of presenting to you now Mr. Ellsworth, Monckton, Tui."
Well, thought Keating, Bennett's won his 6 bits down at the office. There were a few seconds of silence. Then the thing which happened hit Keating on the back of the head. It was not a sound nor a blow. It was something that ripped time apart, that cut the moment from the normal one preceding it. He knew only the shock at first. A distinct, conscious second was gone before he realized what it was, and that it was applause. It was such a crash of applause that he waited for the loudspeaker to explode. It went on and on and on, pressing against the walls of the lobby, and he thought he could feel the walls buckling out to the street. The people around him were cheering. Catherine stood, her lips parted, and he felt certain that she was not breathing at all. It was a long time before silence came suddenly, as abrupt and shocking as the roar. The loudspeaker died, choking on a high note. Those in the lobby stood still. Then came the voice.
"My friends," it said simply and solemnly. "My brothers," it added softly, involuntarily, both full of emotion and smiling apologetically at the emotion. "I am more touched by this reception than I should allow myself to be. I hope I shall be forgiven for a trace of the vain child which is in all of us. But I realize, and in that spirit I accept it, that this tribute was paid not to my person, but to a principle which chance has granted me to represent in all humility tonight."
It was not a voice. It was a miracle. It unrolled as a velvet banner. It spoke English words, but the resonant clarity of each syllable made it sound like a new language, spoken for the first time. It was the voice of a giant. Keating stood, his mouth open. He did not hear what the voice was saying. He heard the beauty of the sounds, without meaning. He felt no need to know the meaning. He could accept anything. He would be led blindly anywhere.
"And so, my friends," the voice was saying, "the lesson to be learned from our tragic struggle is the lesson of unity. We shall unite, or we shall be defeated. Our will, the will of the disinherited, the forgotten, and the oppressed, shall weld us into a solid bulwark with a common faith and a common goal. This is the time for every man to renounce the thoughts of his petty little problems, of gain, of comfort, of self-gratification. This is the time to merge his self in a great current, in the rising tide which is approaching to sweep us all, willing or unwilling, into the future. History, my friends, does not ask questions or acquiesce. It is irrevocable, as the voice of the masses that determine it. Let us listen to the call. Let us organize, my brothers. Let us organize. Let us organize. Let us organize."
Keating looked at Catherine. There was no Catherine. There was only a white face dissolving in the sounds of the loudspeaker. It was not that she heard her uncle.
Keating could feel no jealousy of him. He wished he could. It was not affection. It was something cold and impersonal that left her empty, her will surrendered, and no human will holding hers, but a nameless thing in which she was being swallowed.
"Let's get out of here," he whispered.
His voice was savage. He was afraid. She turned to him as if she were emerging from unconsciousness. He knew that she was trying to recognize him and everything he implied. She whispered,
"Yes, let's get out."
They walked through the streets, through the rain, without direction. It was cold, but they went on, to move, to feel the movement, to know the sensation of their own muscles moving.
"We're getting drenched," Keating said at last, as bluntly and naturally as he could.
Their silence frightened him. It proved that they both knew the same thing, and that the thing had been real.
"Let's find some place where we can have a drink."
"Yes," said Catherine. "Let's. It's so cold. Isn't it stupid of me? Now I've missed Uncle's speech, and I wanted so much to hear it."
It was all right. She had mentioned it. She had mentioned it quite naturally, with a healthy amount of proper regret. The thing was gone.
"But I wanted to be with you, Peter. I want to be with you always."
The thing gave a last jerk, not in the meaning of what she said, but in the reason that had prompted her to say it. And then it was gone, and Keating smiled. His fingers sought her bare wrist between her sleeve and glove, and her skin was warm against his. Many days later, Keating heard the story that was being told all over town. It was said that on the day after the mass meeting, Gail Winand had given Ellsworth Toohey a raise in salary. Toohey had been furious and had tried to refuse it.
"You cannot bribe me, Mr. Winand," he had said.
"I'm not bribing you," Winand had answered. "Don't flatter yourself." When the strike was settled, interrupted construction went forward with a spurt throughout the city, and Keating found himself spending days and nights at work, with new commissions pouring into the office. Francone smiled happily at everybody and gave a small party for his staff to erase the memory of anything he might have said. The palatial residence of Mr. and Mrs. Dale Ainsworth on Riverside Drive, a pet project of Keating's, done in late Renaissance and gray granite, was completed at last. Mr. and Mrs. Dale Ainsworth gave a formal reception as a housewarming, to which Guy Francone and Peter Keating were invited, but Lucius Anhyre was ignored, quite accidentally, as always happened to him of late. Francone enjoyed the reception, because every square foot of granite in the house reminded him of the stupendous payment received by a certain granite quarry in Connecticut. Keating enjoyed the reception, because the stately Mrs. Ainsworth said to him with a disarming smile,
"But I was certain that you were Mr. Francone's partner. It's Francone and Hire, of course. How perfectly careless of me. All I can offer by way of excuse is that if you aren't his partner, one would certainly say you were entitled to be."
Life in the office rolled on smoothly, in one of those periods when everything seemed to go well. Keating was astonished, therefore, one morning shortly after the Ainsworth reception, to see Francone arrive at the office with a countenance of nervous irritation.
"Oh, nothing," he waved his hand at Keating impatiently. "Nothing at all."
In the drafting room, Keating noticed three draftsmen, their heads close together, bent over a section of the New York Banner, reading with a guilty kind of avid interest. He heard an unpleasant chuckle from one of them. When they saw him, the paper disappeared, too quickly. He had no time to inquire into this. A contractor's job runner was waiting for him in his office, also a stack of mail and drawings to be approved. He had forgotten the incident 3 hours later, in a rush of appointments. He felt light, clear-headed, exhilarated by his own energy. When he had to consult his library on a new drawing, which he wished to compare with its best prototypes, he walked out of his office whistling, swinging the drawing gaily. His motion had propelled him halfway across the reception room when he stopped short. The drawing swung forward and flapped back against his knees. He forgot that it was quite improper for him to pause there like that in the circumstances. A young woman stood before the railing, speaking to the reception clerk. Her slender body seemed out of all scale in relation to a normal human body. Its lines were so long, so fragile, so exaggerated, that she looked like a stylized drawing of a woman, and made the correct proportions of a normal being appear heavy and awkward beside her. She wore a plain gray suit, The contrast between its tailored severity and her appearance was deliberately exorbitant and strangely elegant. She let the fingertips of one hand rest on the railing, a narrow hand ending the straight, imperious line of her arm. She had gray eyes that were not ovals, but two long rectangular cuts edged by parallel lines of lashes. She had an air of cold serenity and an exquisitely vicious mouth. Her face, her pale gold hair, her suit seemed to have no color, but only a hint, just on the verge of the reality of color, making the full reality seem vulgar. Keating stood still because he understood for the first time what it was that artists spoke about when they spoke of beauty. "I'll see him now if I see him at all," she was saying to the reception clerk. "He asked me to come, and this is the only time I have." It was not a command. She spoke as if it were not necessary for her voice to assume the tones of commanding. "Yes, but..." A light buzzed on the clerk's switchboard. She plugged the connection through hastily. "Yes, Mr. Francone?" She listened and nodded with relief. "Yes, Mr. Francone." She turned to the visitor. "Will you go right in, please?" The young woman turned and looked at Keating as she passed him on her way to the stairs. Her eyes went past him without stopping. Something ebbed from his stunned admiration. He had had time to see her eyes. They seemed weary and a little contemptuous, but they left him with a sense of cold cruelty. He heard her walking up the stairs, and the feeling vanished, but the admiration remained. He approached the reception clerk eagerly. "Who was that?" he asked. The clerk shrugged. "That's the boss's little girl." "Why, the lucky stiff," said Keating. "He's been holding out on me." "You misunderstood me," the clerk said coldly. "It's his daughter. It's Dominique Francone."
"Oh," said Keating.
"Oh, Lord."
"Yeah?"
The girl looked at him sarcastically.
"Have you read this morning's Banner?"
"No."
"Why?" "Read it."
Her switchboard buzzed, and she turned away from him. He sent a boy for a copy of the Banner and turned anxiously to the column "Your House" by Dominique Francone. He had heard that she'd been quite successful lately with descriptions of the homes of prominent New Yorkers. Her field was confined to home decoration, but she ventured occasionally into architectural criticism. Today her subject was the new residence of Mr. and Mrs. Dale Ainsworth on Riverside Drive. He read, among many other things, the following. "You enter a magnificent lobby of golden marble, and you think that this is the city hall or the main post office, but it isn't. It has, however, everything. The mezzanine with the colonnade and the stairway with a goiter and the cartouches in the form of looped leather belts. Only it's not leather, it's marble. The dining room has a splendid bronze gate placed by mistake on the ceiling in the shape of a trellis entwined with fresh bronze grapes. There are dead ducks and rabbits hanging on the wall panels in bouquets of carrots, petunias, and string beans. I do not think these would have been very attractive if real, but since they are bad plaster imitations, it is all right. The bedroom windows face a brick wall, not a very neat wall, but nobody needs to see the bedrooms. The front windows are large enough and admit plenty of light, as well as the feet of the marble cupids that roost on the outside. The cupids are well fed and present a pretty picture to the street against the severe granite of the facade. They are quite commendable, unless you just can't stand to look at dimpled soles every time you glance out to see whether it's raining. If you get tired of it, you can always look out of the central windows of the third floor and into the cast-iron rump of Mercury who sits on top of the pediment over the entrance. It's a very beautiful entrance. Tomorrow we shall visit the home of Mr. and Mrs. Smythe Pickering." Keating had designed the house, but he could not help chuckling through his fury when he thought of what Francone must have felt reading this, and of how Francone was going to face Mrs. Dale Ainsworth. Then he forgot the house and the article. He remembered only the girl who had written it. He picked three sketches at random from his table and started for Francone's office to ask his approval of the sketches, which he did not need. On the stair landing outside Francone's closed door, he stopped. He heard Francone's voice behind the door, loud, angry, and helpless, the voice he always heard when Francone was beaten.
"To expect such an outrage from my own daughter! I'm used to anything from you, but this beats it all. What am I going to do? How am I going to explain? Do you have any kind of a vague idea of my position?"
Then Keating heard her laughing. It was a sound so gay and so cold that he knew it was best not to go in. He knew he did not want to go in, because he was afraid again, as he had been when he'd seen her eyes. He turned and descended the stairs. When he had reached the floor below, he was thinking that he would meet her, that he would meet her soon, and that Francone would not be able to prevent it now. He thought of it eagerly, laughing in relief at the picture of Francone's daughter as he had imagined her for years, revising his vision of his future, even though he felt dimly that it would be better if he never met her again. Chapter 10 Ralston Holcomb had no visible neck, but his chin took care of that. His chin and jaws formed an unbroken arc resting on his chest. His cheeks were pink, soft to the touch, with the irresilient softness of age, like the skin of a peach that has been scalded. His rich white hair rose over his forehead and fell to his shoulders in the sweep of a medieval mane. It left dandruff on the back of his collar. He walked through the streets of New York wearing a broad-brimmed hat, a dark business suit, a pale green satin shirt, a vest of white brocade, a huge black bow emerging from under his chin, and he carried a staff, not a cane, but a tall ebony staff surmounted by a bulb of solid gold. It was as if his huge body were resigned to the conventions of a prosaic civilization and to its drab garments, but the oval of his chest and stomach sallied forth, flying the colors of his inner soul. These things were permitted to him because he was a genius. He was also the president of the Architects Guild of America. Ralston Holcomb did not subscribe to the views of his colleagues in the organization. He was not a grubbing builder, nor a businessman. He was, he stated firmly, a man of ideals. He denounced the deplorable state of American architecture and the unprincipled eclecticism of its practitioners. In any period of history, he declared, architects built in the spirit of their own time and did not pick designs from the past. We could be true to history only in heeding her law, which demanded that we plant the roots of our art firmly in the reality of our own life. He decried the stupidity of erecting buildings that were Greek, Gothic, or Romanesque. Let us, he begged, be modern and build in the style that belongs to our days. He had found that style. It was Renaissance. He stated his reasons clearly. Inasmuch, he pointed out, as nothing of great historical importance had happened in the world since the Renaissance, we should consider ourselves still living in that period, and all the outward forms of our existence should remain faithful to the examples of the great masters of the 16th century. He had no patience with the few who spoke of a modern architecture in terms quite different from his own. He ignored them. He stated only that men who wanted to break with all of the past were lazy ignoramuses, and that one could not put originality above beauty. His voice trembled reverently on that last word. He accepted nothing but stupendous commissions. He specialized in the eternal and the monumental. He built a great many memorials and capitals. He designed four international expositions. He built like a composer improvising under the spur of a mystic guidance. He had sudden inspirations. He would add an enormous dome to the flat roof of a finished structure, or encrust a long vault with gold-leaf mosaic, or rip off a facade of limestone to replace it with marble. His clients turned pale, stuttered, and paid. His imperial personality carried him to victory in any encounter with a client's thrift. Behind him stood the stern, unspoken, overwhelming assertion that he was an artist. His prestige was enormous. He came from a family listed in the social register. In his middle years, he had married a young lady whose family had not made the social register, but made piles of money instead, in a chewing-gum empire left to an only daughter. Ralston Holcomb was now 65, to which he added a few years for the sake of his friend's compliments on his wonderful physique. Mrs. Ralston Holcomb was 42, from which she deducted considerably. Mrs. Ralston Holcomb maintained a salon that met informally every Sunday afternoon. "Everybody who is anybody in architecture drops in on us," she told her friends. "They'd better," she added. On a Sunday afternoon in March, Keating drove to the Holcomb mansion, a reproduction of a Florentine palazzo, dutifully but a little reluctantly. He had been a frequent guest at these celebrated gatherings, and he was beginning to be bored, for he knew everybody he could expect to find there.
He felt, however, that he had to attend this time, because the occasion was to be in honor of the completion of one more capital by Ralston Holcomb in some state or another. A substantial crowd was lost in the marble ballroom of the Holcombs, scattered in forlorn islets through an expanse intended for court receptions. The guests stood about, self-consciously informal, working at being brilliant. Steps rang against the marble with the echoing sound of a crypt. The flames of tall candles clashed desolately with the gray of the light from the street. The lights made the candles seem dimmer. The candles gave to the day outside a premonitory tinge of dusk. A scale model of the new state capitol stood displayed on a pedestal in the middle of the room, ablaze with tiny electric bulbs. Mrs. Ralston Holcomb presided over the tea table. Each guest accepted a fragile cup of transparent porcelain, took two delicate sips, and vanished in the direction of the bar. Two stately butlers went about collecting the abandoned cups. Mrs. Ralston Holcomb, as an enthusiastic girlfriend had described her, was petite but intellectual. Her diminutive stature was her secret sorrow, but she had learned to find compensations. She could talk, and did, of wearing dresses size 10 and of shopping in the junior departments. She wore high school garments and short socks in summer, displayed spindly legs with hard blue veins. She adored celebrities. That was her mission in life. She hunted them grimly. She faced them with wide-eyed admiration and spoke of her own insignificance, of her humility before achievement. She shrugged, tight-lipped and rancorous, whenever one of them did not seem to take sufficient account of her own views on life after death, the theory of relativity, Aztec architecture, birth control, and the movies. She had a great many poor friends, and advertised the fact. If a friend happened to improve his financial position, she dropped him, feeling that he had committed an act of treason. She hated the wealthy in all sincerity. They shared her only badge of distinction. She considered architecture her private domain. She had been christened Constance, and found it awfully clever to be known as Kiki, a nickname she had forced on her friends when she was well past 30. Keating had never felt comfortable in Mrs. Holcomb's presence, because she smiled at him too insistently, and commented on his remarks by winking and saying, "Why, Peter, how naughty of you," when no such intention had been in his mind at all. He bowed over her hand, however, this afternoon as usual, and she smiled from behind the silver teapot. She wore a regal gown of emerald velvet, and a magenta ribbon in her bobbed hair with a cute little bow in front. Her skin was tanned and dry, with enlarged pores showing on her nostrils. She handed a cup to Keating, a square-cut emerald glittering on her finger in the candlelight. Keating expressed his admiration for the capital, and escaped to examine the model. He stood before it for a correct number of minutes, scalding his lips with the hot liquid that smelled of cloves. Holcomb, who never looked in the direction of the model, and never missed a guest stopping before it, slapped Keating's shoulder and said something appropriate about young fellows learning the beauty of the style of the Renaissance. Then Keating wandered off, shook a few hands without enthusiasm, and glanced at his wristwatch, calculating the time when it would be permissible to leave. Then he stopped. Beyond a broad arch in a small library, with three young men beside her, he saw Dominique Francon. She stood leaning against a column, a cocktail glass in her hand. She wore a suit of black velvet. The heavy cloth, which transmitted no light rays, held her anchored to reality by stopping the light that flowed too freely through the flesh of her hands, her neck, her face. A white spark of fire flashed like a cold metallic cross in the glass she held, as if it were a lens gathering the diffused radiance of her skin. Keating tore forward and found Francon in the crowd.
"Well, Peter," said Francon brightly, "want me to get you a drink?"
"Not so hot," he added, lowering his voice, "but the Manhattans aren't too bad."
"No," said Keating. "Thanks."
"Entre nous," said Francon, winking at the model of the capital, "it's a holy mess, isn't it?"
"Yes," said Keating. "Miserable proportions. That dome looks like Holcomb's face imitating a sunrise on the roof." They had stopped in full view of the library, and Keating's eyes were fixed on the girl in black, inviting Francon to notice it. He enjoyed having Francon in a trap.
"And the plan, the plan. Do you see that on the second floor?"
"Oh," said Francon, noticing. He looked at Keating, then at the library, then at Keating again.
"Well," said Francon at last,
Don't blame me afterward. You've asked for it. Come on.
They entered the library together. Keating stopped, correctly, but allowing his eyes an improper intensity, while Francone beamed with unconvincing cheeriness.
Dominique, my dear, may I present... This is Peter Keating, my own right hand.
Peter?
My daughter.
How do you do? Said Keating, his voice soft. Dominique bowed gravely.
I have waited to meet you for such a long time, Miss Francone.
This will be interesting, said Dominique. You will want to be nice to me, of course, and yet that won't be diplomatic.
What do you mean, Miss Francone?
Father would prefer you to be horrible with me. Father and I don't get along at all.
Well, Miss Francone, I think it's only fair to tell you this at the beginning.
You may want to redraw some conclusions. He was looking for Francone, but Francone had vanished.
No, she said softly. Father doesn't do these things well at all. He's too obvious.
You asked him for the introduction, but he shouldn't have let me notice that. However, it's quite all right, since we both admit it. Sit down. She slipped into a chair, and he sat down obediently beside her. The young men whom he did not know stood about for a few minutes, trying to be included in the conversation by smiling blankly, then wandered off. Keating thought with relief that there was nothing frightening about her. There was only a disquieting contrast between her words and the candid innocence of the manner she used to utter them. He did not know which to trust.
"I admit I asked for the introduction," he said. "That's obvious anyway, isn't it? Who wouldn't ask for it? But don't you think that the conclusions I'll draw may have nothing to do with your father?
Don't say that I'm beautiful and exquisite and like no one you've ever met before, and that you're very much afraid that you're going to fall in love with me. You'll say it eventually, but let's postpone it. Apart from that, I think we'll get along very nicely."
"But you're trying to make it very difficult for me, aren't you?"
"Yes. Father should have warned you."
"He did. You should have listened."
"Be very considerate of Father. I've met so many of his own right hands that I was beginning to be skeptical. But you're the first one who's lasted. And who looks like he's going to last. I've heard a great deal about you. My congratulations.
I've been looking forward to meeting you for years. And I've been reading your column with so much..."
He stopped. He knew he shouldn't have mentioned that. And above all, he shouldn't have stopped.
"So much?" she asked gently. "So much pleasure," he finished, hoping that she would let it go at that.
"Oh, yes," she said. "The Ainsworth House. You designed it."
"I'm sorry. You just happened to be the victim of one of my rare attacks of honesty. I don't have them very often. As you know, if you've read my stuff yesterday."
"I've read it, and..."
"Well, I'll follow your example, and I'll be perfectly frank. Don't take it as a complaint. One must never complain against one's critics. But really, that capital of Holcomb's is much worse than all those very things that you blasted us for. Why did you give him such a glowing tribute yesterday? Or did you have to?"
"Don't flatter me. Of course I didn't have to. Do you think anyone on the paper pays enough attention to a column on home decoration to care what I say in it? Besides, I'm not even supposed to write about capitals. Only I'm getting tired of home decorations."
"Then why did you praise Holcomb?"
"Because that capital of his is so awful that to pan it would have been an anticlimax. So I thought it would be amusing to praise it to the sky. It was."
"Is that the way you go about it?"
"That's the way I go about it. But no one reads my column except housewives who can never afford to decorate their homes, so it doesn't matter at all."
"But what do you really like in architecture?"
"I don't like anything in architecture."
"Well, you know, of course, that I won't believe that."
"Why do you write if you have nothing you want to say?"
"To have something to do. Something more disgusting than many other things I could do.
And more amusing."
"Come on, that's not a good reason."
"I never have any good reasons."
"But you must be enjoying your work."
"I am.
Don't you see that I am?"
"You know, I've actually envied you. Working for a magnificent enterprise like the Wynand Papers, the largest organization in the country, commanding the best writing talent, and..."
"Look," she said, leaning toward him confidentially,
"let me help you. If you had just met Father, and he were working for the Wynand Papers, that would be exactly the right thing to say. But not with me. That's what I'd expect you to say, and I don't like to hear what I expect. It would be much more interesting if you said that the Wine and Papers are a contemptible dump heap of yellow journalism, and all their writers put together aren't worth two bits.
Is that what you really think of them?
Not at all. But I don't like people who try to say only what they think I think.
Thanks. I'll need your help. I've never met anyone. Oh, no, of course, that's what you didn't want me to say. But I really meant it about your papers. I've always admired Gale Winand. I've always wished I could meet him.
What is he like?
Just what Austin Heller called him. An exquisite bastard. He winced. He remembered where he had heard Austin Heller say that. The memory of Catherine seemed heavy and vulgar in the presence of the thin white hand he saw hanging over the arm of the chair before him.
But I mean, he asked, what's he like in person?
I don't know. I've never met him.
You haven't?
No.
Oh, I've heard he's so interesting.
Undoubtedly. When I'm in a mood for something decadent, I'll probably meet him.
Do you know Toohey?
Oh, she said.
He saw what he had seen in her eyes before, and he did not like the sweet gaiety of her voice.
Oh, Ellsworth Toohey, of course I know him. He's wonderful. He's a man I always enjoy talking to. He's such a perfect blackguard.
Why, Miss Francone, you're the first person who's ever...
I'm not trying to shock you. I meant all of it. I admire him. He's so complete. You don't meet perfection often in this world one way or the other, do you? And he's just that, sheer perfection in his own way. Everyone else is so unfinished, broken up into so many different pieces that don't fit together. But not Toohey. He's a monolith. Sometimes when I feel bitter against the world, I find consolation in thinking that it's all right, that I'll be avenged, that the world will get what's coming to it. Because there's Ellsworth Toohey.
What do you want to be avenged for?
She looked at him, her eyelids lifted for a moment, so that her eyes did not seem rectangular, but soft and clear.
That was very clever of you, she said.
That was the first clever thing you've said.
Why?
Because you knew what to pick out of all the rubbish I uttered. So I'll have to answer you. I'd like to be avenged for the fact that I have nothing to be avenged for. Now let's go on about Ellsworth Toohey.
Well, I've always heard, from everybody, that he's a sort of saint, the one pure idealist, utterly incorruptible, and
that's quite true. A plain grafter would be much safer. But Toohey is like a testing stone for people. You can learn about them by the way they take him.
Why? What do you actually mean?
She leaned back in her chair and stretched her arms down to her knees, twisting her wrists, palms out, the fingers of her two hands entwined. She laughed easily.
Nothing that one should make a subject of discussion at a tea party.
Kiki's right. She hates the sight of me. But she's got to invite me once in a while, and I can't resist coming because she's so obvious about not wanting me. You know, I told Ralston tonight what I really thought of his capital, but he wouldn't believe me. He only beamed and said that I was a very nice little girl.
Well, aren't you?
What?
A very nice little girl.
No, not today. I've made you thoroughly uncomfortable. So I'll make up for it. I'll tell you what I think of you, because you'll be worrying about that. I think you're smart, and safe, and obvious, and quite ambitious, and you'll get away with it. And I like you. I'll tell Father that I approve of his right hand very much, so you see you have nothing to fear from the boss's daughter, though it would be better if I didn't say anything to Father, because my recommendation would work the other way with him.
May I tell you only one thing that I think about you?
Certainly, any number of them.
I think it would have been better if you hadn't told me that you liked me. Then I would have had a better chance of its being true.
She laughed.
If you understand that, she said, then we'll get along beautifully. Then it might even be true.
Gordon L. Prescott appeared in the arch of the ballroom, glass in hand. He wore a gray suit and a turtleneck sweater of silver wool. His boyish face looked freshly scrubbed, and he had his usual air of soap, toothpaste, and the outdoors.
"Dominique, darling," he cried, waving his glass.
"Hello, Keating," he added curtly.
"Dominique, where have you been hiding yourself? I heard you were here, and I've had a hell of a time looking for you."
"Hello, Gordon," she said. She said it quite correctly. There was nothing offensive in the quiet politeness of her voice. But following his high note of enthusiasm, her voice struck a tone that seemed flat and deadly in its indifference.
as if the two sounds mingled into an audible counterpoint around the melodic thread of her contempt. Prescott had not heard.
"Darling," he said, "you look lovelier every time I see you. One wouldn't think it were possible."
"Seventh time," said Dominique.
"What?"
"Seventh time that you've said it when meeting me, Gordon. I'm counting them."
"You simply won't be serious, Dominique. You'll never be serious."
"Oh, yes, Gordon. I was just having a very serious conversation here with my friend, Peter Keating." A lady waved to Prescott, and he accepted the opportunity, escaping, looking very foolish. And Keating delighted in the thought that she had dismissed another man for a conversation she wished to continue with her friend, Peter Keating. But when he turned to her, she asked sweetly, "What was it we were talking about, Mr. Keating?" And then she was staring with too great an interest across the room at the wizened figure of a little man coughing over a whiskey glass.
"Why," said Keating, "we were—"
"Oh, there's Eugene Pettingill, my great favorite. I must say hello to Eugene." And she was up, moving across the room, her body leaning back as she walked, moving toward the most unattractive septuagenarian present. Keating did not know whether he had been made to join the Brotherhood of Gordon L. Prescott, or whether it had been only an accident. He returned to the ballroom reluctantly. He forced himself to join groups of guests and to talk. He watched Dominique Francon as she moved through the crowd, as she stopped in conversation with others. She never glanced at him again. He could not decide whether he had succeeded with her or failed miserably. He managed to be at the door when she was leaving. She stopped and smiled at him enchantingly. "No," she said, before he could utter a word. "You can't take me home. I have a car waiting." "Thank you, just the same." She was gone, and he stood at the door, helpless, and thinking furiously that he believed he was blushing. He felt a soft hand on his shoulder, and turned to find Francon beside him.
"Going home, Peter? Let me give you a lift."
"But I thought you had to be at the club by 7.
"Oh, that's all right. I'll be a little late. Doesn't matter. I'll drive you home. No trouble at all."
There was a peculiar expression of purpose on Francon's face, quite unusual for him, and unbecoming. Keating followed him silently, amused, and said nothing when they were alone in the comfortable twilight of Francon's car. "Well?" Francon asked, ominously. Keating smiled.
"You're a pig, Guy. You don't know how to appreciate what you've got. Why didn't you tell me? She's the most beautiful woman I've ever seen."
"Oh, yes," said Francon darkly. "Maybe that's the trouble."
"What trouble? Where do you see any trouble?"
"What do you really think of her, Peter? Forget the looks. You'll see how quickly you'll forget that. What do you think?"
"Well, I think she has a great deal of character."
"Thanks for the understatement." Francon was gloomily silent. And then he said with an awkward little note of something like hope in his voice,
"You know, Peter, I was surprised. I watched you, and you had quite a long chat with her. That's amazing. I fully expected her to chase you away with one nice poisonous crack. Maybe you could get along with her after all. I've concluded that you just can't tell anything about her. Maybe... You know, Peter, what I wanted to tell you is this. Don't pay any attention to what she said about my wanting you to be horrible with her."
The heavy earnestness of that sentence was such a hint that Keating's lips moved to shape a soft whistle, but he caught himself in time. Francon added heavily, "I don't want you to be horrible with her at all." "You know, Guy," said Keating, in a tone of patronizing reproach, "you shouldn't have run away like that."
"I never know how to speak to her."
He sighed. "I've never learned to. I can't understand what in blazes is the matter with her, but something is. She just won't behave like a human being. You know, she's been expelled from 2 finishing schools. How she ever got through college, I can't imagine, but I can tell you that I dreaded to open my mail for 4 solid years waiting for word of the inevitable. Then I thought, well, once she's out on her own, I'm through and I don't have to worry about it. But she's worse than ever."
"What do you find to worry about?"
"I don't. I try not to. I'm glad when I don't have to think of her at all. I can't help it. I just wasn't cut out for a father. But sometimes I get to feel that it's my responsibility after all. Though God knows I don't want it, but still there it is. I should do something about it. There's no one else to assume it." "You've let her frighten you, Guy. And there's really nothing to be afraid of."
"You don't think so?"
"No."
Maybe you're the man to handle her. I don't regret your meeting her now, and you know that I didn't want you to. Yes, I think you're the one man who could handle her. You're quite determined, aren't you, Peter, when you're after something?
Well, said Keating, throwing one hand up in a careless gesture, I'm not afraid very often.
Then he leaned back against the cushions as if he were tired, as if he had heard nothing of importance, and he kept silent for the rest of the drive. Francone kept silent also.
"Boys," said John Eric's knight, "don't spare yourself on this. It's the most important thing we've had this year. Not much money, you understand, but the prestige, the connections. If we do land it, won't some of those great architects turn green? You see, Austin Heller has told me frankly that we're the third firm he's approached. He would have none of what those big fellows tried to sell him. So it's up to us, boys. You know, something different, unusual, but in good taste. And, you know, different. Now, do your best."
His five designers sat in a semicircle before him. Gothic looked bored, and miscellaneous looked discouraged in advance. Renaissance was following the course of a fly on the ceiling. Rourke asked,
"What did he actually say, Mr. Snite?"
Snite shrugged and looked at Rourke with amusement, as if he and Rourke shared a shameful secret about the new client, not worth mentioning.
"Nothing that makes great sense, quite between us boys," said Snite. "He was somewhat inarticulate, considering his great command of the English language in print. He admitted he knew nothing about architecture. He didn't say whether he wanted it modernistic or period or what. He said something to the effect that he wanted a house of his own. But he's hesitated for a long time about building one, because all houses look alike to him, and they all look like hell, and he doesn't see how anyone can become enthusiastic about any house. And yet he has the idea that he wants a building he could love. A building that would mean something, is what he said, though he added that he didn't know what or how.
There. That's about all he said. Not much to go on, and I wouldn't have undertaken to submit sketches if it weren't Austin Heller. But I grant you that it doesn't make sense. What's the matter, Rourke?"
"Nothing," said Rourke.
This ended the first conference on the subject of a residence for Austin Heller. Later that day, Snite crowded his five designers into a train, and they went to Connecticut to see the site Heller had chosen. They stood on a lonely, rocky stretch of shore, 3 miles beyond an unfashionable little town. They munched sandwiches and peanuts, and they looked at a cliff rising in broken ledges from the ground to end in a straight, brutal, naked drop over the sea, a vertical shaft of rock forming a cross with the long, pale horizontal of the sea.
"There," said Snite. "That's it."
He twirled a pencil in his hand.
"Damnable, eh?"
He sighed. "I tried to suggest a more respectable location, but he didn't take it so well, so I had to shut up." He twirled the pencil.
"That's where he wants the house, right on top of that rock."
He scratched the tip of his nose with the point of the pencil.
"I tried to suggest setting it farther back from the shore and keeping the damn rock for a view, but that didn't go so well either."
He bit the eraser between the tips of his teeth.
"Just think of the blasting, the leveling one's got to do on that top."
He cleaned his fingernail with the lead, leaving a black mark.
"Well, that's that. Observe the grade and the quality of the stone. The approach will be difficult. I have all the surveys and the photographs in the office. Well, who's got a cigarette?" "Well, I think that's about all. I'll help you with suggestions any time. Well, what time is that damn train back?"
Thus the five designers were started on their task. Four of them proceeded immediately at their drawing boards. Rourke returned alone to the site many times. Rourke's 5 months with Snite stretched behind him like a blank. Had he wished to ask himself what he had felt, he would have found no answer, save in the fact that he remembered nothing of these months. He could remember each sketch he had made. He could, if he tried, remember what had happened to those sketches. He did not try. But he had not loved any of them as he loved the house of Austin Heller. He stayed in the drafting room through evening after evening, alone with a sheet of paper and the thought of a cliff over the sea. No one saw his sketches until they were finished. When they were finished, late one night, he sat at his table with the sheet spread before him, sat for many hours, one hand propping his forehead, the other hanging by his side, blood gathering in the fingers, numbing them, while the street beyond the window became deep blue, then pale gray. He did not look at the sketches. He felt empty and very tired. The house on the sketches had been designed not by Rourke, but by the cliff on which it stood. It was as if the cliff had grown and completed itself and proclaimed the purpose for which it had been waiting. The house was broken into many levels following the ledges of the rock, rising as it rose in gradual masses, in planes flowing together up into one consummate harmony. The walls, of the same granite as the rock, continued its vertical lines upward. The wide projecting terraces of concrete, silver as the sea, followed the line of the waves of the straight horizon. Rourke was still sitting at his table when the men returned to begin their day in the drafting room. Then the sketches were sent to Snite's office. 2 days later, the final version of the house to be submitted to Austin Heller, the version chosen and edited by John Eric Snite, executed by the Chinese artist, lay swathed in tissue paper on a table. It was Rourke's house. His competitors had been eliminated. It was Rourke's house, but its walls were now of red brick. Its windows were cut to conventional size and equipped with green shutters. Two of its projecting wings were omitted. The great cantilevered terrace over the sea was replaced by a little wrought iron balcony. And the house was provided with an entrance of Ionic columns supporting a broken pediment, and with a little spire supporting a weather vane. John Eric Snite stood by the table, his two hands spread in the air over the sketch without touching the virgin purity of its delicate colors.
"This is what Mr. Heller had in mind, I'm sure," he said. "Pretty good. Yes, pretty good. Rourke, how many times do I have to ask you to not smoke around a final sketch? Stand away. You'll get ashes on it."
Austin Heller was expected at 12 o'clock. But at 11:30, Mrs. Symington arrived unannounced and demanded to see Mr. Snite immediately. Mrs. Symington was an imposing dowager who had just moved into her new residence designed by Mr. Snite. Besides, Snite expected a commission for an apartment house from her brother. He could not refuse to see her, and he bowed her into his office, where she proceeded to state without reticence of expression that the ceiling of her library had cracked and the bay windows of her drawing room were hidden under a perpetual veil of moisture which she could not combat. Snite summoned his chief engineer, and they launched together into detailed explanations, apologies, and damnations of contractors. Mrs. Symington showed no sign of relenting when a signal buzzed on Snite's desk, and the reception clerk's voice announced Austin Heller. It would have been impossible to ask Mrs. Symington to leave, or Austin Heller to wait. Snite solved the problem by abandoning her to the soothing speech of his engineer and excusing himself for a moment. Then he emerged into the reception room, shook Heller's hand, and suggested, "Would you mind stepping into the drafting room, Mr. Heller? Better light in there, you know, and the sketch is all ready for you, and I didn't want to take the chance of moving it." Heller did not seem to mind. He followed Snite obediently into the drafting room. A tall, broad-shouldered figure in English tweeds, with sandy hair, and a square face drawn in countless creases around the ironical calm of his eyes. The sketch lay on the Chinese artist's table, and the artist stepped aside, diffidently, in silence. The next table was Rourke's. He stood with his back to Heller. He went on with his drawing and did not turn. The employees had been trained not to intrude on the occasions when Snite brought a client into the drafting room. Snite's fingertips lifted the tissue paper as if raising the veil of a bride. Then he stepped back and watched Heller's face. Heller bent down and stood hunched, drawn, intent, saying nothing for a long time.
"Listen, Mr. Snite," he began at last. "Listen, I think," and stopped.
Snite waited patiently, pleased, sensing the approach of something he didn't want to disturb. "This," said Heller suddenly, loudly, slamming his fist down on the drawing, and Snite winced.
"This is the nearest anyone's ever come to it."
"I knew you'd like it, Mr. Heller," said Snite.
"I don't," said Heller.
Snite blinked and waited.
"It's so near somehow," said Heller regretfully. "But it's not right. I don't know where, but it's not. Do forgive me if this sounds vague, but I like things at once or I don't. I know that I wouldn't be comfortable, for instance, with that entrance. It's a lovely entrance, but you won't even notice it because you've seen it so often. Ah, but allow me to point out a few considerations, Mr. Heller. One wants to be modern, of course, but one wants to preserve the appearance of a home, a combination of stateliness and coziness, you understand. A very austere house like this must have a few softening touches. It is strictly correct architecturally."
"No doubt," said Heller. "I wouldn't know about that. I've never been strictly correct in my life."
Just let me explain this scheme, and you'll see that it's...
I know, said Heller wearily.
I know, I'm sure you're right. Only...
His voice had a sound of the eagerness he wished he could feel.
Only if it had some unity, some central idea, which is there and isn't. If it seemed to live, which it doesn't. It lacks something, and it has too much. If it were cleaner, more clear-cut. What's the word I've heard used? If it were integrated.
Rourke turned. He was at the other side of the table. He seized the sketch. His hand flashed forward, and a pencil ripped across the drawing, slashing raw black lines over the untouchable watercolor. The lines blasted off the Ionic columns, the pediment, the entrance, the spire, the blinds, the bricks. They flung up two wings of stone. They rent the windows wide. They splintered the balcony and hurled a terrace over the sea. It was being done before the others had grasped the moment when it began. Then Snite jumped forward, but Heller seized his wrist and stopped him. Rourke's hand went on raising walls, splitting, rebuilding in furious strokes. Rourke threw his head up once, for a flash of a second, to look at Heller across the table. It was all the introduction they needed. It was like a handshake. Rourke went on, and when he threw the pencil down, the house, as he had designed it, stood completed in an ordered pattern of black streaks. The performance had not lasted 5 minutes. Snite made an attempt at a sound. As Heller said nothing, Snite felt free to whirl on Rourke and scream,
"You're fired, goddamn you! Get out of here! You're fired!"
"We're both fired," said Austin Heller, winking to Rourke. "Come on. Have you had any lunch? Let's go someplace. I want to talk to you." Rourke went to his locker to get his hat and coat. The drafting room witnessed a stupefying act, and all work stopped to watch it. Austin Heller picked up the sketch, folded it over 4 times, cracking the sacred cardboard, and slipped it into his pocket.
"But, Mr. Heller," Snite stammered, "let me explain. It's perfectly all right if that's what you want. We'll do the sketch over. Let me explain."
"Not now," said Heller. "Not now," he added at the door. "I'll send you a check." Then Heller was gone, and Rourke with him. And the door, as Heller swung it shut behind them, sounded like the closing paragraph in one of Heller's articles. Rourke had not said a word. In the softly lighted booth of the most expensive restaurant that Rourke had ever entered, across the crystal and silver glittering between them, Heller was saying, "Because that's the house I want, because that's the house I've always wanted. Can you build it for me? Draw up the plans and supervise the construction?"
"Yes," said Rourke.
"How long will it take if we start at once?"
"About 8 months."
"I'll have the house by late fall?"
"Yes."
"Just like that sketch?"
"Just like that."
"Look, I have no idea what kind of a contract one makes with an architect, and you must know, so draw up one and let my lawyer okay it this afternoon, will you?"
"Yes."
Heller studied the man who sat facing him. He saw the hand lying on the table before him. Heller's awareness became focused on that hand. He saw the long fingers, the sharp joints, the prominent veins. He had the feeling that he was not hiring this man, but surrendering himself into his employment.
"How old are you?" asked Heller.
"Whoever you are."
26. "Do you want any references?"
"Hell no, I have them here in my pocket." "What's your name?"
"Howard Rourke."
Heller produced a checkbook, spread it open on the table, and reached for his fountain pen.
"Look," he said, writing. "I'll give you $500 on account. Get yourself an office or whatever you have to get, and go ahead."
He tore off the check and handed it to Rourke, between the tips of 2 straight fingers, leaning forward on his elbow, swinging his wrist in a sweeping curve. His eyes were narrowed, amused, watching Rourke quizzically. But the gesture had the air of a salute. The check was made out to Howard Rourke, architect. Chapter 11. Howard Rourke opened his own office. It was one large room on the top of an old building with a broad window high over the roofs. He could see the distant band of the Hudson at his windowsill with the small streaks of ships moving under his fingertips when he pressed them to the glass. He had a desk, 2 chairs, and a huge drafting table. The glass entrance door bore the words, "Howard Rourke, Architect."
He stood in the hall for a long time looking at the words. Then he went in and slammed his door. He picked up a T-square from the table and flung it down again as if throwing an anchor. John Eric Snite had objected. When Rourke came to the office for his drawing instruments, Snite emerged into the reception room, shook his hand warmly, and said, "Well, Rourke, well, how are you? Come in, come right in. I want to speak to you." And with Rourke seated before his desk, Snite proceeded loudly. "Look, fellow, I hope you've got enough sense not to hold it against me. Anything that I might have said yesterday. You know how it is. I lost my head a little, and it wasn't what you did, but that you had to go and do it on that sketch. That sketch. Well, never mind. No hard feelings?"
"No," said Rourke. "None at all."
"Of course you're not fired. You didn't take me seriously, did you? You can go right back to work here this very minute."
"What for, Mr. Snite?"
"What do you mean, what for?" "Oh, you're thinking of the Heller house. But you're not taking Heller seriously, are you? You saw how he is. That madman can change his mind 60 times a minute. He won't really give you that commission, you know? It isn't as simple as that. It isn't being done that way."
"We've signed the contract yesterday."
"Oh, you have? Well, that's splendid. Well, look, Rourke, I'll tell you what we'll do. You bring the commission back to us, and I'll let you put your name on it with mine, John Eric Snite and Howard Rourke, and we'll split the fee. That's in addition to your salary. And you're getting a raise, incidentally. Then we'll have the same arrangement on any other commission you bring in. And, Lord, man, what are you laughing at?"
"Excuse me, Mr. Snite, I'm sorry."
"I don't believe you understand," said Snite, bewildered. "Don't you see? It's your insurance. You don't want to break loose just yet. Commissions won't fall into your lap like this. Then what will you do? This way you'll have a steady job, and you'll be building toward independent practice, if that's what you're after. In 4 or 5 years, you'll be ready to take the leap. That's the way everybody does it, you see?"
"Yes."
"Then you agree?"
"No."
"But good Lord, man, you've lost your mind. To set up a loan now? Without experience, without connections, without, well, without anything at all. I never heard of such a thing. Ask anybody in the profession. See what they'll tell you. It's preposterous."
"Probably."
"Listen, Rourke, won't you please listen?"
"I'll listen if you want me to, Mr. Snite. But I think I should tell you now that nothing you can say will make any difference. If you don't mind that, I don't mind listening."
Snite went on speaking for a long time, and Rourke listened, without objecting, explaining, or answering. "Well, if that's how you are, don't expect me to take you back when you find yourself on the pavement."
"I don't expect it, Mr. Snite."
"Don't expect anyone else in the profession to take you in after they hear what you've done to me."
"I don't expect that either."
For a few days, Snite thought of suing Rourke and Heller. But he decided against it because there was no precedent to follow under the circumstances, because Heller had paid him for his efforts, and the house had been actually designed by Rourke, and because no one ever sued Austin Heller. The first visitor to Rourke's office was Peter Keating. He walked in without warning one noon, walked straight across the room and sat down on Rourke's desk, smiling gaily, spreading his arms wide in a sweeping gesture. "Well, Howard," he said. "Well, fancy that." He had not seen Rourke for a year.
"Hello, Peter," said Rourke.
"Your own office, your own name and everything? Already, just imagine."
"Who told you, Peter?"
"Oh, one hears things. You wouldn't expect me not to keep track of your career now, would you?" "You know what I've always thought of you. And I don't have to tell you that I congratulate you and wish you the very best."
"No, you don't have to."
"Nice place you got here, light and roomy. Not quite as imposing as it should be, perhaps, but what can one expect at the beginning? And then the prospects are uncertain, aren't they, Howard?"
"Quite."
"It's an awful chance you've taken."
"Probably."
"Are you really going to go through with it? I mean, on your own?"
"Looks that way, doesn't it?"
"Well, it's not too late, you know. I thought when I heard the story that you'd surely turn it over to Snite and make a smart deal with him."
"I didn't."
"Aren't you really going to?"
"No."
Keating wondered why he should experience that sickening feeling of resentment. Why he had come here hoping to find the story untrue, hoping to find Rourke uncertain and willing to surrender. That feeling had haunted him ever since he'd heard the news about Rourke. The sensation of something unpleasant that remained after he'd forgotten the cause. The feeling would come back to him without reason, a blank wave of anger, and he would ask himself, "Now what the hell? What was it I heard today?" Then he would remember. Oh, yes, Rourke. Rourke's opened his own office. he would ask himself impatiently. So what? And know at the same time that the words were painful to face, and humiliating like an insult. You know, Howard, I admire your courage. Really, you know, I've had much more experience, and I've got more of a standing in the profession. Don't mind saying it. I'm only speaking objectively. But I wouldn't dare take such a step.
No, you wouldn't.
So you've made the jump first. Well, well, who would have thought it? I wish you all the luck in the world.
Thank you, Peter.
I know you'll succeed. I'm sure of it.
Are you?
Of course I am. Aren't you?
I haven't thought of it.
You haven't thought of it?
Not much.
Then you're not sure, Howard. You aren't?
Why do you ask that so eagerly?
What? Why, no, not eagerly, but of course I'm concerned. Howard, it's bad psychology not to be certain now in your position. So you have doubts?
None at all.
But you said...
I'm quite sure of things, Peter.
Have you thought about getting your registration?
I've applied for it.
You've got no college degree, you know. They'll make it difficult for you at the examination.
Probably.
What are you going to do if you don't get the license?
I'll get it.
Well, I guess I'll be seeing you now at the AGA, if you don't go hi-hat on me, because you'll be a full-fledged member, and I'm only a junior.
I'm not joining the AGA.
What do you mean you're not joining? You're eligible now.
Possibly.
You'll be invited to join?
Tell them not to bother.
What?
You know, Peter, we had a conversation just like this 7 years ago when you tried to talk me into joining your fraternity at Stanton. Don't start it again.
You won't join the AGA when you have a chance to?
I won't join anything, Peter, at any time.
But don't you realize how it helps?
In what?
In being an architect.
I don't like to be helped in being an architect.
You're just making things harder for yourself.
I am. And it will be plenty hard, you know. I know.
You'll make enemies of them if you refuse such an invitation.
I'll make enemies of them anyway.
The first person to whom Rourke had told the news was Henry Cameron. Rourke went to New Jersey the day after he signed the contract with Heller. It had rained, and he found Cameron in the garden, shuffling slowly down the damp paths, leaning heavily on a cane. In the past winter, Cameron had improved enough to walk a few hours each day. He walked with effort, his body bent. He looked at the first shoots of green on the earth under his feet. He lifted his cane once in a while, bracing his legs to stand firm for a moment. With the tip of the cane, he touched a folded green cup and watched it spill a glistening drop in the twilight. He saw Rourke coming up the hill and frowned. He had seen Rourke only a week ago, and because these visits meant too much to both of them, neither wished the occasions to be too frequent.
"Well," Cameron asked gruffly, "what do you want here again?"
"I have something to tell you."
"It can wait."
"I don't think so."
"Well?"
"I'm opening my own office. I've just signed for my first building."
Cameron rotated his cane, the tip pressed into the earth, the shaft describing a wide circle, his two hands bearing down on the handle, the palm of one on the back of the other. His head nodded slowly in rhythm with the motion for a long time. His eyes closed. Then he looked at Rourke and said,
"Well, don't brag about it."
He added,
"Help me to sit down."
It was the first time Cameron had ever pronounced this sentence. His sister and Rourke had long since learned that the one outrage forbidden